You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Thursday, August 1st, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. That's right, folks. I say New York because I'm on vacation right now. Not while I'm recording this, actually. I'm working, obviously. But now, as you listen to this, I'm on vacation. It is vacation week, but you're still getting all new material. That's right. Unbelievable how good I am to you folks. I'm on vacation. Matt may or may not be on vacation. He seems to be reluctant to take it easy and kick back. Michael, on the other hand, is not supposed to be on vacation, but I'm sure he's kicking back and not doing anything. On the program today, Pardis Cabrii, from an interview I did with her at Netroots Nation. She is a lawyer for the Center for Constitutional Rights on Guantanamo Bay. And on the administration's drone program. Also from Netroots Nation, I caught up with Ben Jealous, the executive director of the NAACP. This was prior to the Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act. We talked about that ruling and anticipated what would happen if the Supreme Court was to do that. Also for members today, a replay of the interview with the filmmakers from the Battle for Brooklyn. Really important film, fascinating one. And for members, that's what you get for... For free beers, well, that's what you get, too. So enjoy it. Tomorrow on the program, we will also still be on vacation, but with all new material recorded at Netroots Nation. And we'll talk to you then. We are back. I'm here at Netroots Nation 2013. I am talking to Pardis Cabrii. She is a senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Pardis, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So now you work on a number of different issues in the, I guess, the national security regime, or I should say area. First off, is you represent clients who are in Guantanamo Bay. How many clients do you have, and what can you tell us about them?
CCR represents 9 men who are still detained. We represent men who've been released. We've been representing people at Guantanamo since 2002. We were one of the first people out there challenging the regime at Guantanamo. But today there are 9 people who we directly represent and see frequently still there. I was at the base 2 weeks ago. And what's going on at Guantanamo right now is a mass hunger strike by most of the men who are there. They've been protesting for now over 4 months. Been refusing food for 4 months. The military at the beginning disputed our claims, downplayed them. They themselves right now are saying over 100 people are on strike.
And now there's 180 180 some odd prisoners?
166 who are still there.
And over 100 are confirmed to be on a hunger strike, and nearly 24 at this point are being force-fed.
That's right. More than, I think it's 44 is the military's figure right now. And when I was at the base, earlier this month, I met with, the 3 men I met with were all on hunger strike. One of them was being force-fed. He talked to me about what that's like. It's being tied to a chair at 5 points at your wrists, your ankles, your stomach, your shoulders, your head. You have a mask put over your mouth. You have a tube forced up your nose and down into your stomach, and you sit tied up for an hour while liquid formula is pumped into your stomach. And that is the military strategy right now for making sure that people don't die at Guantanamo.
What? I want to ask about the what you can tell us about those men that you represent and where they fit on the sort of the spectrum, because we know that there are a number of prisoners in Guantanamo Bay that the government at this point acknowledges are not guilty of anything that they would be held for and remain there simply because the government hasn't quite decided or figured out what to do. Can you tell us, like, what specifically is the goal of the hunger strike?
It started out as a different thing. It was sparked by searches of the men's Qurans, and which the men found religiously offensive. They thought it was an act of desecration. Nothing like that had happened in years, and that was the literal trigger point for the strike. I think the background has always been the fact of their indefinite detention, which is now 11 and a half years without charge. At this point, 4 months into the strike, when I ask men, what are you asking for? Is there something that would allow you to end your strike? What the men I've met with tell me now is it would take transfers. It would take seeing people who the government has said don't need to be here leaving. I think it's different for different people, but at least the men I met with and that we represent, that is one thing they've all said.
The men that you represent, where do they fall in those? There are really basically, I guess, 3 categories, right? There are some. Tell us who the 3 categories are and where those men that you represent.
So of the 166, 86 have been unanimously determined by the Obama administration to be eligible for transfer. They've been approved for release. And what that means is that every government agency with a stake in these detentions has unanimously said that these people do not present a security threat to the United States and they don't need to be there. That's more than half of the current population. And I met some of our clients are in that category.
Now is that an explicit or tacit admission that they never represented a national security risk?
I think that the United States has a hard time accepting responsibility for its wrongs. And the administration has been, like the Bush administration, this administration has been very careful to say they no longer present a security threat to the United States. I think that is just a way of just not accepting that these men were wrongfully held to begin with. But the point is, that admission or not, at this point, they have said, the Obama administration has said, that 86 of the 166 don't need to be there.
And so of the remaining 80, I guess it is, what categories do they fall into?
So there's 2 other groups. Of the remaining group, the administration has said it a while back, it said it never planned to charge more than 34 of people being held. Remember that nearly 800 people were held at Guantanamo ever. no more than 34 were ever going to be charged. And that number is even lower now because of a couple of court decisions that have recently come out that have undermined the government's theories about who it can bring charges, what kind of charges it can bring. And so now it's actually more like a couple of dozen. A couple of dozen out of nearly 800. So that's the charged group. And then there's this third made-up category that the government has created, that the Obama administration has created, where it says there's this group of 46, and it's probably a little bit more now because there are people who it had planned to charge but can't charge, no longer can bring charges against. But a group that it says it doesn't have court-worthy evidence against, it can't charge them, but they're too dangerous to release. And that is... that is an entirely problematic category as a matter of law when you start breaking down who we're actually talking about. For a long time, we didn't have the names of who was in that category. There's a list recently released just earlier this week.
Yes.
That listed the names of people who were in that category as of 2010, so it's an outdated list.
How was that list acquired? Do you know?
It was through a FOIA request by Carol Rosenberg at the Miami Herald and some students at Yale Law School that she was working with.
So we have 50, I mean, we don't know the exact number, but we're speculating there's around 50 people who the government says does not have trial-worthy evidence. That's a euphemism for we either don't have evidence that we can gain a conviction or that the evidence that we do have is tainted by the way that we acquired it, most likely because it was coercive to the point of being acquired through torture. Is that right?
That's correct.
And so normally what happens, at least in our judicial system, is if the evidence is bad, the person can't be convicted of anything, and they're therefore found to be not guilty, and they are released. Our government has deemed for secret reasons, right? I mean, we don't know in any of the cases of these individuals, do we have any idea why they perceive these people to be such a security risk?
The government hasn't released the reasons and the information underlying those determinations. So no, we don't know. We have, you know, there are habeas cases that have gone forward, but as far as the Obama administration's own determinations and how it came up with this group of too dangerous to release, we don't have that information or those criteria. The way that the government does this, though, you're right, that normally, right, if you don't have evidence against someone, you can't charge them and you can't continue to detain them. The government's theory is that, you know, these people were captured in war and that we can continue to detain them under the laws of war. The problem, I mean, there are legal problems with that. There are policy problems with that. When you start breaking down, now that we have the names of who is in that category, you see people like one of the men I represent, who I met a couple of weeks ago. His name's Ghaleb Al-Bahani. He's a Yemeni. The government's allegations against him are that he was an alleged assistant cook for a group that surrendered to the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan in 2001 and that disbanded, that no longer exists. His detention was upheld by the appellate court in Washington, D.C., in an opinion that basically disavowed the relevance of international law in determining the legality of his detention. And he is now critically ill. He's been designated as high risk in terms of his health condition. He's told me that medical staff have told him he's at risk of death. He is who is in that group of people, an alleged kitchen hand whose detention was affirmed by a court that basically didn't apply the relevant law and who's now, you know, at risk of death. So I think one thing that's important to do now that we have this list is to actually start breaking down who's in it and trying to scrutinize as best we can, you know, whether it adds up that these people actually, you know, meet this sort of nebulous, too dangerous to release standard.
We've got to take a break. We're talking to Pardis Kebrai of the staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. When we come back, I want to continue this talk about Guantanamo and then also talk about another issue that you deal with, and that's targeted assassination. We've got to take a break. We'll be right back after this. We are back with Pardis Kebrai. She is the staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Pardis, before we broke, you were talking about one of your clients who is a prisoner in Guantanamo who turns up to be on one of the lists, or I should say the only list that we're aware of, of some 50-odd prisoners in Guantanamo who are deemed to be unable to be tried because either there's no evidence or there's no evidence that hasn't been garnered through processes that would be thrown out in a court of law, i.e. torture, or some other coercive means. And that this is someone who, according to your understanding of his case, and you're his attorney, has very little reason to be considered one of those people. So the question that I want to ask you, just sort of building this out into this sort of more policy area, is that President Obama gave a speech, I guess a month, month and a half ago now, where he both signaled and justified another issue that we're going to be talking about, the targeted assassination program, but also signaled a desire to have a new direction in the so-called war on terror, the global war on terror, and said by unilateral action that he was now going to lift the ban on people being returned to Yemen. Now, President Obama has gotten, I think, in some quarters, some unfair criticism for not closing Guantanamo because he could not do that unilaterally. However, what he admitted to us a month and a half ago was that what he could do unilaterally was get almost 80 people out of Guantanamo, which would halve the size of it. Why hasn't he done this before, and what does this mean that he's doing it now?
You know, I think before, you know, he came out very strong, obviously, in 2009. What happened then was that political opposition began to mount, and what we saw was the president retreating repeatedly in the face of that opposition, retreating, capitulating basically to political opposition and political pressure, failing to make to rebut false narratives about who was being held at Guantanamo. And then ultimately, when Congress did make it more difficult for him to transfer people out, Congress did pass a series of restrictions that are incredibly burdensome, but it also allowed the president a national security waiver. There is an important waiver provision in that law that Congress passed that was meant, Senator Carl Levin himself said that provision was meant to be a clear route for transfers to happen in appropriate cases, cases like the 86 who've been cleared. So there is authority that exists despite those restrictions, and it has been President Obama's failure to decide that he's going to take the political risk and use his political leverage to actually exercise that authority. I think it was shelved as a priority. And the only reason I think that he is talking about it again now, and I don't think this is cynical, is because of the hunger strike. You know, I think that the administration's policy has been closure, but there has never been a plan to actually make that a reality. I hope now, you know, that things will be different. I think for things to be different, it will take looking back at what went wrong the first time around and doing things differently. And I don't know yet. I mean, I think to this question of will it happen this time, I think the jury is still out on that. I don't think we have seen anything concretely yet that necessarily indicates that, you know, things will be different. I hope they will be. But what he has done is lift a ban that he imposed and reappoint, you know, reopen an office in the State Department that he closed.
Right.
So he just reversed his own prior bad decisions. That's where we are.
And in regards to your client, who is on this list of 50-some-odd people who are supposedly, there's no good evidence, but there is reason to believe that they're a security risk, What accounts for that? I mean, you know, you're aware of this case. You're looking at this very clearly. The government will not present what the evidence is, supposedly, that they have. There has been, it would be, let's put it this way. By the government's own reckoning, they have made horrible mistakes there throughout the process with hundreds of people who have been there. What is the process for adjudicating? Is there even a process to simply say, hey, look, you got to prove, at the very least, if you're going to indefinite detain under with no statutory or constitutional authority whatsoever, don't you feel at least you should justify it? Or is it at that point, in for a penny, in for a pound.
Well, so at this point, there are two processes where you could challenge detention. Men at Guantanamo still have the option of habeas, which means they can go to federal court and have their cases reviewed. The problem now is that there have been a series of decisions passed by the appellate court in Washington, D.C., which, you know, a few years ago, and that may be changing a little bit now because judges on the court are changing, but has been extremely deferential to claims by the executive of executive power, and, you know, the power to hold has been extremely deferential to the government's interpretations of who it can hold and interpretations of law, and that has basically made it impossible for the government to lose. And that was the court that sanctioned basically the detention of someone like the man I was just talking about, who was
this
alleged.
This is the D.C. Circuit Court, and the President Obama has just nominated three justices to fill vacancies that have been there. And prior to this, it was a 4-3 Republican. Now it is a 4-4.
Right.
But there's also a half dozen judges on bank, I believe, who are also Republican. So do you see that as, I mean, a coincidence that those are happening simultaneously, or?
I don't know that there's necessarily a relationship, but I think it can potentially change the composition of the court. Certainly will influence how decisions come out going forward. There's already been a great deal of bad law created, but that is how the courts for these men have so far been completely ineffectual. And the Supreme Court has refused to accept any case for review since 2008, since that landmark decision in 2008 in Boumediene versus Bush, where it said, affirmed, that men have the right to challenge their detention. So that route for review has not been effective. It has not been meaningful so far. And the second route for review,
it's not been meaningful because they basically said, we're going to side with this, but we're not going to enforce it in some respects.
Yeah, they've gutted review of all meaning. I mean, it is not meaningful review. They have watered down standards for evidence, standards for detention, to the point where it's, you know, the government wins every time. It's no contest. So that is, and the Supreme Court has not gotten involved. So the D.C. Circuit Court has basically become the court of last resort.
Mm.
You know, that doesn't mean the Supreme Court can't take another challenge in the future. It doesn't mean that the D.C. Circuit's opinions won't change moving forward if the composition of the court is different. But that is what's happened so far. And then the second process that exists are these review boards, these administrative review boards that the president has set up to periodically review the detentions of that group of people who it says it can continue to hold.
And that's obviously all secret. We have no idea what it is that they're reviewing or...
Well, you know, the information that they'll be relying on will be classified. They've said they'll provide unclassified summaries to the detainee and to counsel representing that person. I mean, I think, you know, if these boards are to have any kind of credibility at all, there needs to be access to the information that the government's relying on, or how can you present a meaningful challenge? And I think if things like that don't happen, these review boards will look exactly like the combatant status review tribunals under the Bush administration, for example, that were completely inadequate and uncredible. So I think it remains to be seen if these new boards are going to have any credibility at all. But the point, again, goes back to, you know, the really faulty legal basis for holding these people, and then just, it's just bad as a matter of policy. And President Obama said that himself. He said, you know, it is unsustainable to continue holding people indefinitely in perpetuity in no man's land without charge. I mean, how long are we going to continue to do this, particularly as the U.S. starts withdrawing from Afghanistan and winding that down that war? You know, what war are we talking about? He's been out there more recently talking about, you know, an end to perpetual war and needing to turn the page finally. So hopefully that happens. But, you know, I think it's misguided as a matter of law and policy to continue holding people without charge.
So, Pardis, I want to just, and I appreciate your time,
sure.
But one of the topics I want to also talk about is the target assassination program. And there are two aspects of this that are really problematic, I think. I mean, from my perspective, it's just that we have this entire program is justified on essentially secret law, which the concept of which I think is very problematic. And in many respects, trying to to give the color of law to assassination programs, I think, is also problematic. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm trying to prioritize here on some level. Give me your sense of what we know of this secret law and how it is developed. And I know this isn't necessarily part of your portfolio, but is what is happening with this secret law in terms of this assassination program in any way similar to the secret law, sort of the secret case law in some respects, that was developed under the FISA court to justify the expansion of 215 of the Patriot Act?
So what we know so far of this program is that the administration has said its legal theory is that that the United States is engaged in a global armed conflict with al-Qaeda and associated forces, not just in Afghanistan, but wherever in the world suspects may be, and that it can use lethal force under the laws of war, the laws that govern warfare, against these people through drones or other weapons, wherever in the world they may be. It is said that it can lawfully target people who are members of these groups. And it has not defined further what membership means. It has also not defined further what associated groups means. And it hasn't exactly defined the precise boundaries geographically of where this war exists. We know that there have been...
Or imminent threat. Right. I mean, they have a very broad definition
Absolutely.
Of imminent threat, which just basically means that in the past, it seems like you were dangerous.
Right. So very recently, the president came out with a bit more. In his speech last month, he outlined new criteria. He said that would be tighter criteria that would govern targeting. He said we won't target people unless they present an imminent threat, like you said. Capture is infeasible, and the risk of civilians dying, there's a near certainty that civilians won't die.
Capture is infeasible actually also had a broader definition of including, like, does not represent a significant danger to our military personnel.
Right.
And that seems to be, you could drive a truck through that, right?
I mean, well, and
people die in training.
And we could look at concretely what we know just looking at the imminence criterion, for example. It says imminent. One would think imminent means immediate. If you look at the leaked white paper on the targeting of U.S. citizens that came out back in February, there was a white paper, a summary that was leaked about the government.
And this is a summary of the opinions.
Of the opinion
that have been
itself.
Written in support of this.
We haven't seen the opinions themselves, but there has been this summary that was leaked. And the definition of imminence there, the Justice Department's interpretation was that imminence doesn't actually require imminence. You don't need an imminent, you don't need an immediate threat. You don't need clear evidence of an immediate threat, an actual immediate threat in the future. So that is the way they've been interpreting imminence. And that's, again, just in this summary white paper. But I think based on what we know through leaks, that there is real reason to be very skeptical of how the government is interpreting even these ostensibly narrower criteria. But the point, as you said, is we just don't know yet. And the government says, Obama says there is congressional oversight. Well, it took the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is tasked with oversight of this program, repeatedly demanding the legal memos about the targeting of U.S. citizens alone and threatening to hold up John Brennan's confirmation as head of the CIA for that committee, which is tasked with oversight, to be able to see those legal memos. I mean, that is the Senate committee itself.
Based upon what you've read of these things, is your sense that these legal memos were written up post hoc, in other words? Were they written up after the fact of al-Awlaki being assassinated as a way of justifying the action?
Well, I mean, we know from the leaked white paper that it was written after the fact of his killing.
And do you have a sense of, now, supposedly there's three other Americans who have been assassinated under this program, but apparently, according to the administration, or at least some reporting, that at least two were sort of accidental. And one of whom was al-Awlaki's son, a 16-year-old boy who was searching for his father. But this is 2 weeks later, and he had at that point given up on the search and was at a cafe with a cousin.
Right.
So give me your sense of that. I mean, what do you think happened there? Is it that they felt that they couldn't justify it after the fact, after these targeted assassinations, they realize they're going to have to hold to be held account to these. So I'm going to create a retroactive legal framework. But I realize that it's not going to fit all of these cases. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that what happened? I mean, do you have a sense of what happened?
You know, well, so CCR, along with the ACLU, has a lawsuit challenging the legality of the killings of three of those U.S. citizens, Anwar al-Awlaki, Samir Khan, who was killed with him in a strike in September of 2011 in Yemen, and then the killing of 16-year-old Abdulrahman al-Awlaki in October of 2011. And the point there is to say to the government, explain what happened. Explain the standards you use, your legal criteria, explain the circumstances, and let's let a fair, independent tribunal determine the legality of your actions. So we don't know, and that's the point of this lawsuit that the government is fighting. It is fighting, its position is basically that U.S. courts have no role at all in reviewing the claims by U.S. citizens that their constitutional and due process rights were violated. That is the administration's position. And it is astounding that the administration thinks that all it needs to do in terms of accountability is for Eric Holder to write a letter to Congress, which he did last month, acknowledging finally, 2 years after the fact, that yes, the government actually carried out these killings. It killed these four American citizens, to defend its actions in a letter, and then to think that it can close the book, you know, based on that alone. It thinks that, you know, acknowledging the killings, defending its actions in a letter to Congress should be enough. And our position is that can't be enough.
When Eric Holder described justifying the process in which people end up on this list, and he said that due process does not need to include a jury trial. And I think there is precedent for that, but I don't know that there's precedent for that in the context of state-sanctioned killing or, frankly, incarceration. Is there anything that can really hang on from a legal standpoint?
No, and I think that point that you just made is the point. The deprivation we're talking about is the most extreme deprivation there could be. It's a deprivation of life by the state without charge or trial. And when you've got that kind of a weighty interest on the other side, it is not enough for the government to say that all we need to do is to have national security officials sit around a conference table and look at baseball cards of potential targets and make decisions based on closed secret memos, and that robust process is enough. It can't be enough, and that precedent is extremely dangerous.
I mean, if that constitutes due process,
right.
Why do we need a jury trial in any situation?
Absolutely.
I mean, you're talking about killing somebody.
Right.
So the idea of you're going to go to jail for 6 months, well, you're not being killed.
Right.
There's no point for a jury trial
right.
there either. I
right.
mean, right? I mean, this
right.
seems to open up the door to basically saying, you know what? We can save the taxpayers a lot of money.
Right.
They're just not going to have jury trials.
Right.
I mean, that may sound, I guess, hyperbolic in some respect, but I mean, this is what it literally means.
Well,
if you can kill, you know, by deeming, there are some people who are just so wise amongst us
right.
that they can supplant a judicial
right.
process.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, I think it is not, the facts are the facts. It's not hyperbolic. The facts are that these decisions are made closed door by national security officials entirely unilaterally on the basis of standards we don't know, on the basis of information that has never been reviewed. And then as for any other branch of government checking those decisions, well, you know, again, look at the Senate Intelligence Committee. Before they started demanding those legal memos, they didn't know what the standards were. So that's as far as congressional oversight. The public doesn't know what's going on. And the government's position with respect to the courts is to stay out.
Let me ask you, I mean, we've been talking about this stuff in sort of a theoretical level, but as an attorney who is working in these areas, who's representing specific clients in these areas, for you, what is, and maybe it's both, I don't want to give you a false choice here, but what drives, when you think about how problematic, as an understatement, these situations are, is it what is happening to the individuals involved, or is it what is happening to the fabric of
the law, you know, as you see it, and the implications that it can have further down the road?
You know, it is both. It is both about challenging sweeping assertions of power that come down on the heads of ordinary people. And Guantanamo is the perfect example of that, where you had the full force of the United States, the military, coming down on foreign citizens who it said, you know, it could hold indefinitely without anyone having a matter of having a say in it. So I think it's certainly about challenging that kind of assertion of power. I think a lot about the precedent that these policies are setting internationally and the world that I want to live in, and whether that's one where other countries, for example, could claim the same targeting authority that the U.S. is claiming right now to be able to target their citizens and foreign citizens in countries around the world. That isn't a world that I want to live in. But ultimately, it is also very much about the human beings that I've met, that we work with, and what they have gone through. And, you know, the policies of the Bush administration and the Obama administration over the past more than a decade have devastated individual lives, their communities, and countries. And one of the things I think we try to do at CCR is to try to make that impact visible, because I think it is still largely, to the mainstream of the American public, invisible. We've talked about men at Guantanamo on this offshore island prison. We're talking about drone strikes in other countries without much cost to the United States. There aren't troops that are being killed. There's not a great deal of cost. These are civilians in Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia and wherever else who are dying and whose communities are being destroyed, but we don't see those images. So I think part of what's important to me in doing this work is very much about making that impact known and giving people information as a starting point to then be able to decide if these are the policies they want carried out in their name.
Pardis Kabrai from the Center for Constitutional Rights, thank you so much for your
thank
time.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, joining me now at Netroots Nation 2013 is Ben Jealous. He is the current president and chief executive officer of the National Association of Advancement of Colored People. Ben,
also known as the NAACP.
Also known as the NAACP. Ben, thanks for joining us. Now, it is now June 21st. We don't know when we're going to hear about the Supreme Court's decision on Section 5.
But very likely next week.
Very likely next week. So give me a sense of the import of Section 5 over the years.
Sure. I mean, look, Section 5 is the... Section 5 is the heart of a pillar of U.S. law called the Voting Rights Act. Right? This is what allows the federal government to defend citizens of color against blatant attempts to suppress the vote of minorities in this country. And
we should say this is the preclearance requirement that there's about 11 states or so, many counties in those states and counties as far north as New York and Queens,
right,
that are subject to preclearance by the Department
as
of Justice.
As far west as California.
And they're subject to preclearance by the Department of Justice. Material changes to their voting must be pre-cleared by the Department.
That's right. And this can be changing of polling places. It can be the rescheduling of an election. It can be changing the rules of how you go about voting, like the imposition of voter ID. Unfortunately, all those things have been used in recent years, like the last few years, to suppress black voters, brown voters. The Voting Rights Act was reapproved in renewed in 2006 because of 15,000 pages of testimony and a couple dozen hearings in the Congress and the Senate about what had happened recently. And in the last couple of years, we've actually seen things get much worse than they were even in 2000 or the early 2000s when, you know, a city in Mississippi canceled its election because the all-white city council and the white mayor woke up one day and realized that they were facing a black majority at the polls for the first time. And so if it is overturned or diminished in any way, it'll be outrageous because the Supreme Court has reaffirmed the Voting Rights Act in Section 5 four times in the last four decades because the U.S. Senate voted 98-0 two abstentions the last time that it approved the Voting Rights Act in 2006, and because we have used the Voting Rights Act again and again. Our country has used it again and again in very recent years, including last year, to stop strategies that were intentionally designed to suppress the black vote, to suppress the brown vote, to suppress the vote of Native people. And so it's vital, and if Section 5 is damaged in any way, our democracy as a whole will be diminished.
Let's talk, I mean, you know, obviously at this juncture, we don't have any opinions released. We only have what we recall from the oral arguments. But what do you make of Scalia's argument that when it was ratified, or I should say reapproved, reauthorized back in 2006, 98-0 with two abstentions, that was really more a function of the senators not really politically having the room to vote against it, even though it wasn't necessary? I mean, I think I'm fairly characterizing.
Yeah, well, he said that, you know, I mean, let's say what he said, right? I was sitting right there in the courtroom. He said that that voting rights are a racial entitlement, that racial entitlements are intimidating for politicians. And that's why you've seen support for the Voting Rights Act agree. I mean, sorry, excuse me. Then that's why you've seen support for the Voting Rights Act grow every decade as fewer and fewer senators have voted against it. It's a completely ahistorical analysis. I mean, it couldn't be, perhaps, you know, that we're just further and further away from the days of segregation, that we're further and further away from having people like Strom Thurmond controlling blocks of votes in the U.S. Senate. I mean, you know, he acted as, you know, just completely ahistorical argument that was insulting to the senators. It was insulting to people of color. It should be insulting to every citizen of this country. This notion, you know, voting rights are a democratic entitlement, are an American entitlement, period, end of story. And, you know, but they do this, you know, they pretend that the blacks switched to the Democratic Party because we wanted free stuff, because of the New Deal. And they don't talk about Barry Goldwater. They don't talk about the Republicans sort of giving safe quarter to the Dixiecrats. They want to ignore the very real, painful racial history of this country. And quite frankly, for men of Scalia's age, they often want to ignore their own role in it.
There was a tremendous amount of laws passed across the states in the past, particularly the past two and a half years, that restricted people's rights to vote, some which were struck down via Section 5, some which were struck down subsequent to the fact through courts.
Some that were vetoed by governors, including Republican governors in Michigan and Virginia.
And so, but despite the fact that some of those actually managed to stay on the books, we had for the first time African American voter participation greater than white voter participation. Do you think that? I mean, it was reported as this was a backlash. That the threat, the ongoing and active threat to people's franchise inspired more people to vote.
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. You know, what we saw last year was very much the backlash to the backlash, and that was the story of 2012. And You know, we at the NAACP, who are number three in the country for nonpartisan voter registration, number one for door-to-door voter registration, but also very much leading the fight to defend our all citizens' voting rights in states across this country, intentionally made sure that we made the fight visible. We looked at 2011 when people's, you know, when we saw the cresting of this wave, which can simply be defined as more states pushing more. More states passing more laws, pushing more voters out of the ballot box in a single year, which became a single legislative session, two-year session, than we had seen in any year or single legislative session in the past century, since the rise of Jim Crow. We saw the cresting of the wave in 2011, and no one was talking about it, and it scared us. And so we got dozens of organizations to organize a big protest in New York on Human Rights Day that started the Koch brothers' headquarters, ended at the UN, but went past every major network and cable TV news outlet, and started pushing coverage in late 2011 of this issue and all through 2012, and that made a big difference in motivating people. With that said, we also had to kill voter suppression legislation in 15 states, and we did, and some of the laws passed. And despite the fact that they passed, the reality is that we were able to motivate black folks and register black folks to vote in higher numbers and higher frequency than ever happened before. First time black voters were more likely than white voters to vote. With that said, the obstacles are real. The obstacles suppressed the vote. They simply suppressed it, kept it lower than it could have been, as opposed to forcing it to be lower than it had been.
So So give me a sense of, and there's two things that, the two questions that's raised. One is, will we see more of that? Will we see more of that backlash in the event that, in the event that Section 5 is struck down?
Well, yeah, this is one of those.
Or
oh, certainly. I mean, certainly there is a playbook that will be put in place on the by the far right wing the moment Section 5 is struck down. We will, but even if it's not struck down, we will continue to see more and more of these laws. I mean, let's be really clear.
But I'm asking about, do you think that you're going to be able to, that we're going to see the same mobilization and backlash to the
backlash?
Yes.
The look, a law is forever, or at least it lasts until you get rid of it. And motivation is momentary. And
right.
So the reality is that once they succeed in getting a law in place, the motivation dies pretty quickly thereafter.
So sustaining that energy in response is going to be very difficult over time.
It's going to be very difficult over time. With that said, you know, we have made miracles happen twice before. You know, people, you know, a year ago, recently as a year ago, were saying, oh, there's no way, you know, black people are going to turn out like they did in 2008. You know, in 2012. There's no way that students were going to be as excited. There's no way that black men were going to be as excited. You know, maybe black women, but overall, you were going to see suppressed turnout, and it just didn't happen. And it didn't happen because we organized. You know, the NAACP in 2012 registered more than three times as many people as it did in 2008. In 2008, we did about 124,000. In 2012, I think we did 376,831. The reason that we have that number precisely is because we got 600 communities across the country to use the van system to target their efforts, made a tremendous impact. And so, you know, we will continue to organize. But let us be really clear, because that something has changed. When we were, you know, all of us, certainly all of us who were, you know, born since 1950, what we were really accustomed to is people breaking the law to suppress the vote. What we're much less familiar with is people passing laws to suppress the vote. And this is a playbook that's as old as the country itself. You know, when the country was founded and the revolution had been accomplished, John Adams and the patricians looked at the populace who made up the privates of the Revolutionary Army and said, we ain't letting y'all vote either. John Adams said it would be mobocracy if we let landless white men vote. Not just women, not just blacks, but most white men. And so the very theory of many of our founders was in a constrained electorate that represented a very privileged few. The progressive movement has stood against that from the very beginning, you know, as represented by John Adams' wife writing him and saying, don't forget the women. And the crusade that began from that point and went on for almost 150 years until it succeeded. And so our responsibility in this moment is to recognize that things have changed. That they're taking an old playbook off the shelf. The last time they took us off the shelf was right after the Civil War. That stayed off the shelf for about 40 years. And that we are now in a generational fight to defend our democracy. And we have to be prepared that we will be in this battle till at least 2042 when this country becomes majority people of color. And perhaps the far right wing will have to adjust their strategy.
Ben Jealous, president of NAACP, thank you so much for joining us.
Appreciate you. Thank you. Satan, I will pay.